Coming up, our look at the top religion and ethics news of the year 2009, a special report.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're yourretirementcompany.com. Also by the Henry Luce Foundation and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Welcome, I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. This is our annual look back at the major stories in religion and ethics during the year now coming to an end. We do this with the help of Kevin Ekstrom, the editor of Religion News Service, with E.J. Dion of the Brookings Institution, the Washington Post, and Georgetown University, and with Kim Lawton, managing editor of this program. We begin with Kim's reminder of the top news of 2009.
So help me God.
President Barack Obama took office on a strong note of hope, and he signaled right off the bat that religion would have a role in his new administration.
We are a nation of Christians and Muslims, Jews and Hindus, and non-believers.
He expanded President Bush's faith-based office and set up an unprecedented new advisory council of top religious leaders. Many of his speeches included religious rhetoric, notably his controversial visit to Notre Dame, where he called for a new common ground on abortion, and his address while accepting the Nobel Peace Prize. One of his most important speeches was at Cairo University in Egypt, where he pledged a new and improved relationship between the U.S. and the Muslim world. American Muslims praised the Cairo speech as a defining moment in their efforts to be considered part of the American mainstream. But the Muslim community also faced new challenges about extremism in its midst after the Fort Hood massacre, allegedly by a Muslim army officer, and the arrest of five young American Muslim men who were suspected of going to Pakistan to join terrorists.
Blessed are you, O Lord our God, creator of the universe.
Religious activists waged aggressive campaigns for health care reform, but their efforts were hampered by a divisive battle over funding for coverage of abortions. Faith leaders actively lobbied on both sides of that question. Lawmakers in Vermont, New Hampshire, Maine, and the District of Columbia all approved measures to legalize same-sex marriage. However, voters in Maine overturned that state's law before it could take effect. The new laws put increasing pressure on religious denominations about whether their clergy should be allowed to marry gay couples. Issues surrounding homosexuality continue to divide mainline Protestants. The Evangelical Lutheran Church in America voted to allow local congregations to hire non-celibate gay and lesbian pastors. Opponents are now moving to split off and form their own denomination. Delegates to the Episcopal Church's General Convention voted to end their moratorium on gay bishops. The Episcopal Diocese of Los Angeles then elected a lesbian assistant bishop, whose election must still be confirmed by representatives of the entire Episcopal Church. The U.S. actions heightened tensions within the worldwide Anglican Communion. Meanwhile, Pope Benedict XVI made it easier for disaffected Anglicans to convert to Roman Catholicism. The Vatican announced new structures that will allow converting Anglicans to retain some of their distinctive beliefs and practices. During a trip to the Holy Land, Benedict worked to mend fences with the Jewish community after he lifted the excommunication of a traditionalist bishop who denied the Holocaust. The recession continued to take a toll on faith-based groups and the people they serve. Religious institutions were forced to slash their budgets and lay off staff, even as they were asked to do more to help people. The Jewish community also continued to feel the fallout from the Bernie Madoff scandal, with many Jewish organizations losing millions of dollars. And as the world faced a swine flu epidemic, religious groups were among those struggling to respond. Congregations made changes in their worship practices to help stop the spread of H1N1. New preventative policies were also instituted at this year's Hajj, or pilgrimage to Mecca.
Kim, thanks for that. There was an enormous number of enormous issues all at once confronting this country and especially President Obama.
Well, exactly. I think he took office amid this great optimism, and reality set in pretty quickly of the many complex things that need to be done.
Mm-hmm. And E.J., at Oslo, when he received the Nobel Prize and spoke about going to war.
Well, in fact, you know, Obama could have evaded the paradox of a president who's just sent 30,000 troops into Afghanistan and getting the Nobel Peace Prize, and instead he embraced that paradox. And he gave what I think is one of the most powerful arguments for a just war approach to foreign policy that we have heard from a president in a long time, perhaps ever. And you could hear the echoes of Reinhold Niebuhr's Christian realism. A lot of us have talked about how Obama is a Niebuhrian. I think you saw it very clearly there. And he also, in a way, was bringing us really back to a kind of Truman-Roosevelt sort of liberalism out of the late 1940s, where there were echoes of the Four Freedoms in that talk. And I think it's rare that you get a president sort of laying out the moral assumptions behind his choices, but that's what Obama did in that speech.
And Christian realism being, how do you define that?
Well, Christian realism is sort of based on the idea that it's the obligation of the human beings to try to bring justice to a sinful world. And it acknowledges human failure. It acknowledges that utopias cannot be built on this earth, but it asserts that human beings have the capacity to make things better and that human beings have to make choices, some of them very, very difficult.
And that human beings have the capacity to make things worse, too.
Right, and I think there was a kind of moral humility in that speech where Obama was not celebrating the need to go to war. He was talking about it as a tragic necessity. And that is, again, not something you often hear from President of the United States, who often has to call men and women to war.
Yeah.
But I found it interesting that while, as E.J. said, there was this philosophical and some would say theological underpinning in that speech, it really disappointed a lot of religious liberals who did not want to see a buildup in Afghanistan and were concerned about the president using some of these concepts to, in fact, bolster a war effort.
But I think that's really an old argument between just war liberals and pacifists. And pacifists have a consistent ethic on war, but it's not the same as the one held by just war theorists. And what was interesting is Obama said, look, I am in a different position than Gandhi or Martin Luther King because I am the leader of a nation. And I thought that was a very interesting moral distinction he chose to make.
And again, the realism.
Yeah, and I think one of the interesting things that the Oslo speech pointed out was the comfort and the ability that this president has in speaking out in religious terminology. And you saw that when he was in Cairo speaking to the Muslims, he invoked the Quran and the Prophet Muhammad. And when he was in Notre Dame speaking to the Catholics, he talked about Catholic social teaching. And when he's talking, accepting the Nobel Peace Prize, he's talking about war and peace and sin and human frailty. And so, I mean, this is a president who's very comfortable using religious language.
And you don't get the impression, at least I don't, that there's anything forced about this, that it seems to come naturally.
That's right. And, part of the reason why he was able to speak, I think, so clearly to the Muslim world is because he has Muslims in his own family. Mm-hmm. There is a naturalness and an authenticity there that I don't think you see very often in very many politicians.
But in the Muslim world and outside this country in the Muslim world, is there then how do we stand? After Cairo, there was such enthusiasm for what Obama had said, and then there was this escalation in Afghanistan.
Well, it's a little bit of a mixed bag because I think American Muslims here at home felt very gratified by the things that he was saying. And it's important to note, I think, that in Cairo, he was not just speaking to the Muslim world. He was not just speaking to Saudi Arabia and Egypt, but he was talking to the folks here at home, Muslims who have pretty much had to go underground for a good part of this decade. And now they're sort of reemerging in political life. And I think he was speaking to them. But as we saw with Fort Hood and the shootings there, they have some serious problems of their own that they're going to have to deal with in terms of homegrown extremism.
By the way, it is intriguing that President Bush came under a lot of criticism for using religious language, and that, in fact, in some ways, a more liberal or progressive president may be invoking religious language even more than Bush did, albeit in a very particular way. But on the Cairo speech, it got an enormously positive response from the Muslim world. And then the president ran head-on into the difficulties of resolving the Israeli-Palestinian dispute. And I think that that was one of the real failures of the year for the president. Now, maybe it wasn't something that he could succeed at, but I think that he had sort of expected the Israelis to do certain things, and it was probably unrealistic to expect that. Having done that and made some effective promises to the Palestinian leaders, they felt let down. And so he really is, if not back to square one, awfully close. And I think it's going to be one of his real challenges in the coming year is to try to restart some process.
After the shootings at Fort Hood and after the five Muslim young men from Northern Virginia ended up in Pakistan, apparently wanting to join the Al-Qaeda, has there been some increase, Kim, in the concern that most people in this country have about Muslims in this country?
Well, I know that's the concern the Islamic community has. They're very worried about how they're being perceived outside, as well as being worried about what's happening within their midst, you know, and among their own young people. And so I'm hearing a lot of Muslim leaders, U.S. Muslim leaders, saying we need to do a better job of combating some of the hate speech that's out there, especially online. They need to do a better job of talking about their view of Islam, which they think is being distorted by a lot of extremists. So they are very worried about how all of this is affecting not only, you know, the outward stuff, but their own internal problems as well.
When Fort Hood happened, I got an email from this fine officer I've gotten to know where he said, you know, this was a terrible, tragic problem because on the one side, clearly some folks somewhere along the line had fallen down on the job in protecting the troops from this shooter. On the other hand, he said, I have troops under me who are Muslim, who are very loyal Americans, and we have to keep a balance here of preserving security for our troops without sort of throwing into one pot all of these Muslim American soldiers who are very loyal to the country.
Let me turn your attention to some of the social issues of the year, especially abortion coming back with such strength in that debate as a part of the health care debate, and the issues around gay marriage, homosexuality. Talk about that, Kim.
Yeah, there's a lot to talk about. There was a lot of activity on both of those issues. Certainly with the issue of abortion, we saw that moving to the center, especially in the health care debate. Of course, some of the tensions were already heightened. You had the murder of Dr. Tiller in his church, a doctor who performed abortions. And then you had an abortion opponent who was murdered while holding anti-abortion signs. And so some of the rhetoric and the tensions had already been heightened. And I think in the health care debate, you saw that issue really putting a big challenge on people that wanted to have health care reform. Even the U.S. Catholic bishops who said, we want to see health care reform, but not if in any way it includes funding for coverage of abortions.
And it's always, abortion has always been one of those issues that's been kind of a litmus test for politicians. You know, how do you stand on that one issue, and that sort of translates into how people view your larger profile. But I think what was interesting this year was that it became a litmus test for your, if you're a politician, for your respect for people of religious faith who don't support abortion. So if you supported health care that included some sort of abortion provision, then all of a sudden you obviously didn't respect people of faith who were opposed to it. So it became, I think, even more of a litmus test this
year.
You
know, what's fascinating about the health care fight is, in a broad sense, both sides had agreed ahead of time that they weren't going to fight about abortion, and then they had a fight about abortion. The agreement was neither side would use the health care debate to push beyond existing law, the Hyde Amendment, which essentially prohibits government funding for abortion except for a case of rape, incest, and where a mother's life is at stake. But then they couldn't agree on what it meant to preserve the status quo. The House passed the Stupak Amendment which essentially said any insurance policy sold on the government, the exchange that might get government subsidies, none of them could cover abortion. Then the Senate came up with another compromise, which essentially said if you get coverage in your policy, you're going to have to pay for it separately. It would be a tiny amount of money. What's amazing is they finally did seem to settle it. We'll see this play out for at the beginning of the year. But it shows how persistent this fight is when you can't even agree on the definition of the status quo. Yeah.
And this has been a challenge for President Obama, who at his big speech at Notre Dame, for example, said, we're going to find common ground on abortion. And everybody was expecting a big statement or some kind of thing on common ground on abortion. I think the end of the year showed that it's tough to find common ground there.
Even within your own party.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And what about the gay issues, especially in the churches?
Well, looking at it in the religious denominations, it proved to be a huge challenge. Generally speaking, as more states legalized gay marriage, that put a challenge for religious clergy. Do you perform a same-sex wedding if your national denomination doesn't approve of that? And so there were a lot of tensions at the local level for clergy. I think on a denominational, institutional level, we saw the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, mainline denomination, lifting its ban on clergy who are in a relationship. They only had allowed celibate gay clergy in the past. And, of course, the Episcopalians and the Anglicans are still fighting about this issue. This summer, the U.S. Episcopalians said gays and lesbians are eligible to be bishops. And this is something the International Anglican Communion, that the U.S. Church is part of, said, we don't want to see you move forward on this. And the U.S. Church said, we're moving forward anyway. And indeed, Los Angeles has elected a lesbian bishop. Her election must be still confirmed. But it's put enormous new tensions on the worldwide Anglican Communion.
Mm-hmm. And the fights within the churches are really a proxy for a larger fight within society over this issue. And we saw that in this year over gay marriage. And it's hard to remember that this year saw the birth of gay marriage in Iowa, Vermont, New Hampshire, and Connecticut, and also the District of Columbia. So it's not just that the churches are fighting about this, but they are fighting a version of a national fight.
And all this, what's going on internationally, what's going on with these social issues, is happening against the background of a recession that's having just profound effects on the churches, denominations, as well as on everybody else.
You know, what's striking about this year is that there was an occasion where we might have had a very large moral argument about the nature of capitalism, about what kind of capitalism do we want to have, what are the responsibilities of people in the finance sector. We had some of that debate. Pope Benedict came out with a very strong encyclical that in some ways put him to the left of President Obama. But I think we didn't have the larger debate that you might have expected, partly because I think we were numb from the economic troubles, desperate to make sure that we didn't fall off the precipice into something much deeper. But I don't think this is over yet. I think we are destined to have a larger moral debate about the nature of capitalism and how we want it to work.
I've been astonished that there wasn't more visible and perhaps even violent protest about the bailout of the big financial institutions, and at a time when everybody at the Main Street level was suffering so much. It seemed to me, you know, if it had been the days of the Civil Rights Movement or the anti-Vietnam War movement, there would have been people in the streets, and that didn't happen. Well, it did happen on the right, didn't it?
Well, I think what you've got an essentially progressive president in power. There's been some grumbling on the progressive side that President Obama hasn't been tough enough on Wall Street, and I think that grumbling will continue, and I think he's going to respond to it. But given that you have a progressive president in power, it's not surprising that this populism has taken a sort of conservative or right-wing form, and it's directed less against Wall Street than the government bailing out Wall Street. And that just may be a natural result of where politics are at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Kevin, there's some Vatican news, Pope news.
There is. This was sort of, I think, a watershed year for the Pope in that you saw the real contours of his papacy emerge. He is sort of doing things on his own timetable for his own reasons, sort of regardless of what people are going to say. So he's going to welcome back traditionalists, even if one of them turns out to be a Holocaust-denying bishop. He's going to find shelter for the Anglicans. even if it's going to upset interfaith or ecumenical relations. And as we ended the year, he's going to move Pope Pius XII, the World War II Pope, who's accused of not doing enough to save Jews. He's going to move him one step closer to sainthood. So it's almost like either the Pope doesn't care what people are going to say, or he doesn't know, but he sort of is doing things on his own timetable.
Mm-hmm. I think he'd make this a lot more palatable to a lot of people if he were also moving to canonize Pope John the 23rd, one of the great heroes to progressive Catholics. I think one of the things you saw is about the organization of the Vatican. Some of these things seem to happen when one part of the Vatican acted without another part of the Vatican knowing that it had acted. This was particularly the case with the St. Pius XII Society, where there were parts of the Vatican that didn't really realize they were moving this quickly. And some folks in the Vatican said, we could have told him about the problem that he was going to have with this Holocaust-denying bishop if someone had just told us that this was going on.
Right, and the Christian Unity Office really didn't know about his outreach to the Anglicans to offer them shelter. It's almost like the left hand doesn't quite always know what the right hand is doing.
That's been a problem at the Vatican for a long time, though. I mean, that's not unique to this papacy. I think one of the differences is sort of the personality still that you see the differences between John Paul II and the great love and, you know, just positive feelings that he generated. Benedict doesn't have that same kind of charisma, and so I think he gets criticized for some of the same things that happened under the John Paul II papacy.
Let me ask you all a question. Did you see any signs in this year past of that tell you something about how the whole religious enterprise is doing? Is it getting stronger? Is it getting weaker? Is it just kind of rolling along? 16% of people in the poll say they're unaffiliated. What do you see? Is there anything that can tell you about the health of religion in the United States?
You know, sometimes I think only God knows what the health of religion is in any given country. I think what you're seeing is that the old story is still true, that compared to other wealthy industrialized countries, we are still an exceptionally religious nation. But I think you're also seeing in some of the surveys, particularly among young people, perhaps the rise of a certain amount of secularism or perhaps just disaffiliation from religious traditions. And young people are often less engaged in religious activity than older people, but this seems to be a change over time. And I think that's going to be something to watch, because you may have among young people a kind of sorting out that had not happened among older people. You do have a very significant number of highly religious young people, but that some other young people who might in the past have been believing doubters or doubting believers but still engaged in religious institutions are now pulling back altogether. At least that's a hypothesis that I think we're going to follow for a while.
The old categories don't fit as strongly as they used to. You know, people are moving around a lot more. That doesn't necessarily mean they're becoming less religious. Even the, you know, unaffiliated very often are deeply spiritual or even deeply religious, just not within a particular box that the old categories used to put them in.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you, as you look back, whether you see some things that from your perspective now didn't seem to get the attention when they were happening that they deserve. They were underreported.
There are two very interesting cases in Oregon and Wisconsin about faith healing deaths, where children who were denied medical care died and their parents were put on trial. And in Wisconsin, the parents were sentenced to probation. In Oregon, the parents basically got off. And there's a third case coming up in 2010 in Oregon. But it was a really interesting clash between personal beliefs and public responsibility. And it's not going away, so there'll be more to watch on that.
Mm-hmm. I think that what the activities of President Obama's faith-based office, how he's changed and hasn't changed what President Bush did in this area, is probably an underreported story. But it's underreported because I think this is exactly the way the administration wants it. I think that they have been very determined in the first year not to make waves in this area, to be reassuring to people. And so the underreporting of this story is probably a victory for the administration.
Kim, did you see
him? I really watched a growing religious coalition, a very deep, diverse coalition, on the issue of nuclear nonproliferation. And it's not something people really paid a lot of attention to, but there are evangelicals who are taking this on as an issue, sort of like they did the environment and that kind of build. I'm seeing the same thing, mainline denominations, even the Catholic Church and evangelicals coming together saying we're really worried about this issue.
Well, thanks to Kim Lawton and to Kevin Ekstrom and E.J. Dion. A wonderful discussion. Thanks very much. Happy New Year to you and to our viewers. That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. Our full discussion is available online, and a podcast of this program is also available. Join us at pbs.org.